With Robinhood, not only can you trade individual stocks and ETFs, you can also seamlessly buy and sell crypto at low costs. Trade all in one place. Get started now on Robinhood.
Trading crypto involves significant risk. Crypto trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Crypto LLC. Robinhood Crypto is licensed to engage in virtual currency business activity by the New York State Department of Financial Services. Crypto held through Robinhood Crypto is not FDIC insured or SIPC protected. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. Securities trading is offered through an account with Robinhood Financial LLC. Member SIPC, a registered broker-dealer.
That was an excerpt from Hemsel's Etude Repos d'Amour, and it was played by Daniel Grimwood. I'm Erica Worth, and welcome to this pianist podcast. Today I am catching up with a British pianist to find out what he's been up to. Daniel, it's lovely to have you on the pianist podcast today.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I mean, you and I have known each other a long time. You've written for Pianist. I've heard you on record and also live. But what I'd like to start with today is your research associate position at the University of York. It sounds intriguing. So if you could expand on this.
Oh, well, certainly. I mean, that's been a really sort of different development in my life. My background is as unacademic as you could possibly imagine.
Okay.
I never even graduated. My career started quite early. So
okay.
Most of my life has been spent as a performer. And then this position became available, and I read the job description. I thought that sort of sounds like it was tailored to my particular interests. So I went for it with no real expectation of getting it, and ended up becoming a researcher. There we go. I think, you know, kind of almost by accident, like all the best things in life.
Wow, how interesting. What was the job description? Was there anything about music?
Oh, yeah. So basically, this is part of a large project from the clarinetist Dr. Emily Worthington. And she's been researching all sorts of things surrounding Carl Behrmann, the 19th century clarinetist. And she needed to work with a pianist. But since we started working together, it sort of developed into all sorts of interesting directions. So as a pianist, I was completely unaware of this, and most people are. Carl Behrmann had a son who was also called Carl Behrmann. Confusingly enough, Carl Behrmann Jr., he's published as, who was a pianist who studied with Liszt.
Okay.
And he was also a composer, though his compositions are long forgotten. But I found some of them, and they're incredible. We don't really know how many exist. So far, there's an opus of etudes. There's the Polonaise Pathétique, which is a very large-scale grand work. And Emily went on a trip to Boston, where Carl Behrmann Jr. lived and worked, and found some manuscripts of his in a box. Hidden away somewhere. So I'm in partway through transcribing them into Sibelius to create an edition of him. But I'm recording them, I think probably early on next year.
Oh my goodness. Well, and what kind of style are they? Are they very virtuosic, very romantic?
Well, they're beautiful. I mean, that's the first thing when you read through them, is you think, wow, it's just so poetic. So starting off with the etudes, I mean, there are a couple of very powerful influences. So he was from Munich.
Okay.
And I believe he was in the same class as Sophie Menter, the great 19th century pianist. And on their syllabus was the music of Adolf von Henselt, the etudes of Henselt. So he would have been very familiar with Henselt's etudes, and that shows in his own. But I think also when you look at the late Moscheles etudes, there's quite a strong echo of them in his music.
Wow.
They're really stunning. They're really beautiful and a joy to play.
Wow. This will require a lot of heavy duty work on your part.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting, but it's also it's kind of a responsibility when you're learning something that is just that unknown. First of all, if you're learning a piece of music by Chopin or Liszt, we've grown up listening to recordings of them, and I think you already have a blueprint in your brain. It's easier to learn this stuff. And when you don't really have any preconceived ideas of a piece, it takes a little bit longer to find your feet with the music. Well, that's my experience anyway.
My goodness. And nobody, would you know of any past legends, keyboard legends that would have performed this
Oh
music?
yes. I mean, what's really cool is that he after he moved to America, one of his students was Amy Beach. And I've found some concert programs of Amy Beach's where she's performing music by her teacher. So yeah, absolutely. His students formed a Carl Behrman Society in Boston. But that sort of died a death at some point, and for reasons that aren't, I don't really don't know what the reasons are. There's an article about him in the Etude magazine from I think 1902 or 1903.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
And one of the things that the writer says that is that he had a personality that didn't really
Oh.
scream out for publicity. He was quite a demure and charming character. So maybe as he wasn't one of these people who sort of screamed and shouted about his excellence, therefore he just sort of fell by the wayside, which is a shame.
Is this Carl Berman? It's not Karel Berman, is it? I'm looking.
No, it's Carl Behrman, Behrmann.
Okay.
So there's two of them. So in fact, Papa Behrmann was the son of the even more famous Heinrich Behrmann, who was the clarinetist that Weber worked with.
Okay.
So Carl Behrmann grew up playing the Weber Grand Duo with his father.
Okay, interesting.
Carl Behrmann Senior. It gets really confusing.
I'm going to really do my research on this. Sounds wonderful. And of course, you will be making world premiere in terms of recording.
Yes, I believe so. Unless yeah, I think they're going to be the first ever recorder and actually performances in modern times. Played some of his music. Emily and I had a concert at university in the concert hall, and we played some of his music and we've recorded it as well.
Anything we can watch or listen to on YouTube or anything?
Not of the Carl Behrmann Jr. I'm afraid I had a memory slip. I'll stop at it, I'm human.
God, memory slips are the worst, aren't they?
There are bigger problems in the world, so I'm not that fussed about them.
That very good attitude to take.
I've said this to my to students of mine on more than one occasion before they've gone on stage and said, nobody ever left a recital from the audience saying, I'm going to remember this for the rest of my life because it was so efficient. No audience member has ever said that. It's not really a priority. But if it's going to go out online, I need it to not have a memory slip in the
I understand. I understand. Though memory slips do happen. Well, this is so interesting about Carl Berman, and you mentioned Adolf von Henselt. Of course, you've got a deep love and admiration for this composer. Tell us how all that began with Henselt, von Henselt.
Oh well, there was a musicologist called Richard Beatty Davis, and his widow Gillian Davis is still a very, very close friend of mine. Richard, despite our great difference in age, I would describe as one of my closest friends. He passed away quite a few years ago,
Oh.
so I think I first met them when I was 7 or 8, maybe. And they were my first violin teacher wanted me to go and play for them, and they were trustees of the Purcell School, so sort of nudged my family and my teachers in the direction of me auditioning for the school. So anyway, Richard was an expert in Russian music, and he part of his life's work was to document all of the Beliaev edition, and he created this. It's like a work of art, this book, The Beauty of Beliaev.
Okay.
Published by G. Clef Publishing, and in it you've got illustrations of all of these title pages from this turn of the century Russian edition. Many of them are decorated with gold leaf. I mean, they're exquisite, they're absolutely beautiful. And because I can read Cyrillic, he enlisted me to help with cataloguing the compositions, like everything.
Okay.
There's a lot. This is a lot of music from
Interesting.
some composers well known, some composers less well known. And that's also the origin of my great love for the music of Felix Blumenfeld, came from this cataloguing job when I was in my, I suppose, 18 or 19 at the time. So one
Okay.
day when I was at Richard and Gillian's, he produced, I'd sometimes just find something in the pile of music I was working through and go, well, that looks really interesting. Let's take it down to the piano, give it a go. So I was at the piano and he put the Henselt piano concerto front of me, and I thought, I won't tell you what I thought. I thought, gosh, that's one of the most difficult pieces of music I've ever seen, but also one of the most beautiful. And that began my love affair with the music of Henselt, and I later learned about how sort of crucially important he was in the progress of 19th century piano music, and in particular Russia.
Okay.
And there are a handful of pianists from Western Europe who became very, very important in Russia, and he was one of them, John Field, a few generations before. And through his teaching activities, primarily, he was made the inspector of the Imperial Schools of Music for young women for all of Russia. So every single governess who was
Wow.
educated in Russia would hand on Henselt's piano method to her students. So sort of
How interesting is that?
that's a really interesting thing. Also, that he was the teacher of Nikolai Zverev, who taught Rachmaninoff.
Oh, okay.
So sort of a very direct link there. Rachmaninoff actually recorded one of the Henselt etudes. It's very, very fast and very beautifully. See you as say, it's amazing.
Oh, how
Yeah,
lovely.
really good recording.
I haven't heard that. But you've recorded his complete etudes, haven't you, Henselt's?
I have my miracle recording that was in lockdown, and I still to this day the day of recording, I didn't believe it was actually going to happen until the red light went on. It's a miracle I got there, because I recorded in the composer's birth town, but at that time we weren't allowed into the next county, far less to another country, so I had
Goodness.
to have written permission from the States to go to Germany.
Yeah.
Then there were cancelled flights and all sorts of things went wrong, and it kept me busy.
Goodness. So do you think if COVID hadn't happened, you most probably wouldn't have undertaken such a task?
I would have done it, but I wouldn't have had as much time to practice them. It's one of the only projects in my life where I've had enough time to practice.
Everybody said that, even like Stephen Half, who I spoke to, said, "Oh, it's been fantastic. I've been able to practice.
Yeah,
Yeah,
that's
nothing
true.
else to do." Wow, amazing, amazing. How many etudes are there in total?
There are, depending on how you count them, well, there's the two opuses. Like Chopin, he wrote two opuses of 12.
Okay.
Then capitalized on by publishers, there's a set of piano pieces, I can't remember the opus number, that were published as etudes but really aren't.
Okay.
And I think publishers did this sometimes. If something had been spectacularly successful, they would want to give something the same title.
Okay.
And kind of pieces that have no business being described as etudes. The same thing happened with Vidor and waltzes. His waltzes
Okay.
were quite popular, so they published pieces as waltzes, and they're really not waltzes. So that sort of thing happens. There is one really vicious little etude in A minor in repeated notes, that was written for the instruction of the young women of St. Petersburg, according to the title page. And then also, more interestingly, he was one of the contributors to the method of methods of Moscheles and Fetti, which is my current area of study.
Right, okay.
But the only three etudes that most people know from the method of methods are the Trois Nouvelles Etudes by Chopin.
Okay.
They were composed for the method, but Henselt also contributed La Gondola,
Goodness.
which has been a very popular concert piece in its time. Godofsky recorded it. There are
I don't know it. You play it.
I play it, yeah.
Yeah. Nice name, La Gondola.
Yeah, it's a beautiful piece.
I'm
Yeah,
gonna look it up.
two pages of calm. Yeah, really beautiful.
Two pages of calm.
Yeah.
Oh, great. Even better. I noticed that you occasionally like to write, do your own transcriptions. Is that right?
I've done transcription writing, though. I mean, I have a Again, I say this to my students, it's in the tradition of pianists to compose. It's part of our tradition,
It is, yeah.
to compose, transcribe. And that is because I think nobody knows how to make a piano sound amazing better than a pianist does.
Okay.
So when composers who weren't pianists wrote for the piano, they didn't necessarily have the knack of making, giving the piano that little bit of extra sheen, shall we say. So pianists know how to do this.
Very interesting.
Whether it was Liszt or Paul Pabst, for example, the Onegin paraphrase, more recently Stephen Hough, and Mikhail Plednyov with the amazing Nutcracker transcription. Pianists are good at this sort of thing, so I think
Yes.
it should remain part of our tradition.
Absolutely. But you're kind of known really for your unusual repertoire? I mean, obviously you've played all, I don't know if you've played any of the Beethoven sonatas or
I've actually played all of them at some
wow.
point. At some point, I've played all. I don't think this is a really bad thing to confess to. Maybe it'll change in life. You know, life is full of changes. But I don't consider myself to be very good at Beethoven. I don't. That and this is a really weird thing. I think the only sonata I've ever played from the Beethoven sonatas where I've come off stage and thought, "Yeah, I'm really pleased with, really, totally pleased with how that went," was the Hammerklavier.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
Again, I've not actually played it for quite a few years, but that was the only one where I thought. But then maybe that's because of the slow movements. I mean, I think as an audience member, if I hear a pianist playing the Hammerklavier, I want the slow movement to be stunning, and I don't really care what the other ones are. That's a terrible thing to say, but that's how it is.
Well, there are some Beethoven sonatas that are like out of this world, like, opus 110, for example.
There are, and I obsess about them. And certainly during lockdown, I found myself playing just for my own pleasure, an awful lot of Beethoven, and actually an awful lot of Haydn.
Okay.
Haydn, I enjoy playing. Again, this isn't repertoire that I'm very frequently invited to play, so I don't, therefore. But for my own pleasure, I play him quite often.
Yeah, interesting. Haydn more so than Mozart.
Differently. Differently, I think playing Haydn is a really deeply human experience. He wears his imperfections without shame. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's a sort of honest. I'm not. This isn't to denigrate Mozart at all. By
No.
any stretch of the imagination, you can't compare
No.
two geniuses in that way. But there is something really very human in Haydn. I was,
Yes, no, I
you
agree.
know, I was thinking that the other day when I was listening to the London symphonies, and I thought there's a certain ruggedness to the way he's gone about things that I just find very attractive. You know, it's not so very polished always,
No.
and it doesn't need to be, and that would sort of miss the point anyway.
Interesting. Interesting. So, in terms of repertoire that you're practicing on at the moment, I believe you're off to a festival in Germany quite soon. Is that this month? Yes. Tell
Yes,
us
it is.
about
Yeah, I'm. It's a what I refer to as a monster program. It evolved through discussions with the organizer. It's the Rarities of Piano Music Festival in Husum,
Yeah.
and it does what it says on the tin.
Rare music.
The whole program. I mean, the all of the pianists who are playing there seem just such fascinating music being played. And this is the thing about the piano, our wonderfully diverse instrument, is that the repertoire is simply limitless.
Yes.
And you can find things like Carl Behrmann, and you think it's just an accident of posterity that this stuff fell by the wayside. It's not inferior in sense to the stuff that has stayed with us. And so fe a festival like this sort of gives a voice to those composers who have been forgotten. I mean, for me, one of the most interesting finds has been Josefa von Flath, who was the teacher of Adolf von Henselt.
Okay.
And she's listed on the Sophie Drinker Institute, which lists the work of all of many, many women who have been forgotten. And she's on that database. And it says that there are compositions for various chamber ensembles. I found there are two a cappella Catholic masses. I found reviews of performances of those masses in Munich from the 1840s. Another thing, how many women were writing and having Catholic a cappella
Amazing.
masses performed in 1840? And it was absolutely incredible. So I found one rather slight piano piece in the library in Munich, which was a rondo which is dedicated to Princess Matilda of Bavaria. I assume that's Matilda Caroline, and I think it likely that Josefa von Flath was actually her piano teacher.
Okay.
But she was Henselt's formative piano teacher, and she was quite high and mighty. She was married to a privy councillor, and she was very good friends with Weber. Weber mentions her in his diaries. He said, I think one of the diary entries was, we heard a piano quartet played by composed by Josefa von Flath. Es war recht gut. Pretty good.
Oh, fantastic. So you're playing some of her music in Germany?
I'm starting with her music, followed by her student Henselt. And things like historians, It's gone down in history that he was a student of Hummel.
Okay.
If we believe Lamara, who was one of the historians that wrote about a lot of the luminaries in the 19th century, she claims that Henselt didn't like Hummel, and that he was in any case already a fully formed virtuoso by that time. So I think therefore that you have to say that his main piano teacher was Josefa von Flath, and I've always kind of refused to accept that she would have been rubbish if she taught one of the finest virtuosi in the 19th century.
Oh.
So it's very difficult to actually get conversations started with discovering her compositions or stuff, or far less getting them performed.
Yes.
But I'm really, really pleased and proud to say that one of the masses is going to be played late, sorry, sung later this year as part of a mass in Schwabach where Henselt was born.
You going to go and hear
Hell yeah. Yeah,
it?
absolutely. I'll be there. I wouldn't
Oh,
miss it for the world.
fantastic.
So it'll be really good to, hear what it actually sounds like. So she studied counterpoint with Abbe Vogler, that really famous contrapuntist in the 19th century. So Henselt referred to himself as Vogler's grandson, meaning that he studied with a student of Vogler. I mean, I think that was a very big deal.
Oh, okay.
So her command of learned counterpoint is absolute.
Well, oh, I look forward to, I'm going to be there actually. I'll be listening to you.
You'll be in Husserl, that's so cool. That's
Yeah, looking forward to it. And other th oh, Henselt on the program. Okay, all
we've got
right.
Fedor's piano music, which is
Vidor.
yes.
Fantastic.
As with all of the best things in my life, I always say happen basically by accident. So there's this book, Vidor, A Life Beyond the Toccata,
Ooh.
by Simpson. Everybody who's ever been married knows the Vidor Toccata, I guess. So this was written by John Arneer, who is an American organist and Vidor expert. And
Okay.
I ended up getting to know him quite well. He lived in Florida at that time. And I have this memory of driving around the Florida countryside and coastline with him playing recordings of Vidor's other music to me. So every time I hear Vidor, I just associate it with sunshine and beautiful seaside stuff. And again, rather like Richard and Henselt, he just produced all of this piano music that I didn't know existed
Amazing.
by Vidor. And I think the last pianist who really played it a lot was probably Isidor Philipp.
Okay. Well, we look forward to listening to it and hear some, but I'd like to now go back. And I'm sure listeners would like to know how you became a pianist, where it all began, how it all began. Who did you study with? Did you go
Well,
down the normal route of
it
competition?
began, I suppose, with Mrs. Hammond.
Your first piano teacher.
No, not at all. She was our next door neighbor, but she had a piano.
Ah.
So, Mrs. Hammond and her husband, Charlie had been a farm laborer. Mrs. Hammond, she was educated, I think, up to the age of 14 and then went into service as many young working class women of that time did. So we're sort of late 19th century, I suppose. I'm not entirely sure what year she was born. I only ever knew her as quite aged, but at some point she must have learned to play the piano. And I think that music education was that there was probably more of it than we realize going back then. Anyway, so I used to probably spend more time at their house than at mum and dad's, and I think people started noticing that I was copying things that I'd heard on the TV radio. So the next thing, dad bought me home an electric keyboard thing, which I worked out very, very quickly. So I think it was just, well,
Oh.
better get the boy some music lessons.
Okay.
So then my first piano lessons were with Jenny, Dr. Jenny Coleman, who was doing her, I think when she was teaching me, she was doing her doctorate at, was it Goldsmiths, I think?
Okay. And I believe you studied with Graham
I
Fitch.
studied with Graham at the Purcell School, yes, and it's really thanks to Graham, I would say, that I made an absolute decision that a pianist is what I would be, because that was by no means certain. I'd never known whether I was going to be a violinist, a pianist, whether
Wow.
composition was going to go to the forefront. I think some people expected me to disappear into academia because I was always a bit sort of spotty. And
Wow. Well, how old were you then? Did you decide to become a pianist?
I think I started taking lessons with Graham when I was 15, I think.
Okay.
So 15 to the end of sixth form, and he was it was a revelation. I mean, Graham was just incredible.
Yes, he is.
Opened possibilities to me that I hadn't really understood existed. And I have to say, in a very short space of time as well, raised my level of piano playing to something where I thought, actually I could do this.
Well, he must have seen your potential.
I think he was somebody who is somebody who just wanted whoever he was teaching to enjoy what they were doing as much as possible. And so everything was about enjoyment, and the better these work, the more you enjoy it. That's the
Fantastic. So important. You're right. And then, well, I guess the rest is history.
well, so I mean, the beginning of my career was pretty catastrophic. I had a brief stay at the Royal North, and I was thrown out actually. Probably wasn't a model student, but anyway, on the same day that happened, I had a house break in and was lucky to get out of the situation alive. So it was these two things
Oh my
happened
goodness.
on the same day actually, and it was devastating. So I was ni 19. I was quite ill afterwards, and gave up music, in fact.
Oh dear.
And I remember I was sort of signing on at Tunbridge Job Centre, going to these job interviews, and I thought, even Marks and Spencer's don't in Tunbridge Wells don't want me to stack shelves for them. I'm basically unemployable. So then it happened, just completely going back to this thing of things happening by accident, that Peter Feuchtwanger was giving a masterclass close to where I live,
Yes.
and it was a friend of my mother's made us aware of this, and basically helped arrange a scholarship for me to spend a week of study with Peter.
Wow.
Peter kind of Lazarus'd me. He was just a wonderful, kind, gentle presence in my life who really just sort of elevated my understanding of music. And it was very opposite to everything that I'd been taught before, not only in terms of the physicality of how we play the piano. I mean, Peter was very much about using the minimum possible muscle tension to create sound,
Yes.
and then maybe a slightly more analytical approach to the music itself than I was accustomed to. Graham had studied, had had a Russian professor, and in Manchester I'd studied with Vladimir Ovchinnikov. So I
Okay.
was used to this. One aspect of Russian music teaching is that it's highly narrative, descriptive and narrative, so everything was based on images. And just studying with Peter, you started understanding the actual beauty of the construction in a way that I hadn't really fully appreciated before.
Okay.
So it balanced everything out.
Fantastic.
Again, it was a case of I don't believe that people come into our life. People who are prominent in our lives appear or disappear by accident. I don't believe that. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe this is something that we impose on our history afterwards when we look back. But I can't help thinking that the time at which I met Peter was just so fortuitous.
Wow, interesting. He came along at the right time.
Absolutely at the right time, yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad that you've got such a successful career now. It's wonderful. Yeah, I'm sure you just can't believe it.
Well, I suppose because I've only ever really done the one thing, I don't have very much to compare it to, and it's not an easy career.
No.
And we're all very fond of saying that, but on the other hand, the job satisfaction is absolutely incredible. So not
Absolutely.
many people get to be able to say that their hobby is their job.
You're so right. You're so, and you meet so many wonderful people, like-minded people, don't you? And
Yeah.
I mean, it is amazing. It is amazing. Well, I mean, actually, to be honest, we're getting quite close to the end, but right now, I want to ask you some rather light-hearted questions off the cuff. And it'd be really interesting to hear what you have to say. So the first question, here we go. If you could play only one composer from now on, who would it be?
Oh, now you've got me. Because I give you an answer today and I give you another answer tomorrow. Schubert.
Schubert.
I can never get bored playing Schubert.
Ah.
It's Schubert and Liszt together. I see them as quite similar.
And I thought you were going to say Beethoven. After all that Beethovening. Oh, interesting. Schubert and Liszt, you said.
Schubert and Liszt have been the composers who have been constant travel companions my whole life.
Okay.
As far back as I remember, I've wanted to play music by them.
Oh,
They're things that they both wrote things that sparkle in the darkness, you know.
absolutely, absolutely. And Liszt, of course, arranged Schubert, didn't he?
Yeah, I don't, and yeah, and I don't think it's accidental that he was so preoccupied with Schubert. You know, I think there are similarities.
Very interesting. Well, yes.
In a spiritual sense, if not a
Yes.
sense, there are definitely
Yeah,
similarities.
you're right. Okay, next question. One pianist, dead or alive, you travel long and far to hear.
Oh, there we go. Anton Rubinstein, I think.
Composer and pianist.
Yeah.
Have you played
I
any of
think
his?
he's, yeah, I mean, actually, his fourth concerto is one of my favorite concertos, but I think that part of the thing is because he was so celebrated in his lifetime, and you hear the best of his compositions, like the Sonata for Four Hands is a masterpiece. Leslie Howard introduced me to that piece, actually. It's just absolutely incredible music. The Persian Love Song, I mean, that melody is the ultimate earworm. The fourth piano concerto, and he wrote a whole series of crackers, but he also wrote a load of music that is well written and uninteresting.
Okay.
And then I start thinking to myself, is that the case because we never heard Rubinstein playing it? So I reckon that he had something absolutely extraordinary about his playing. It wasn't connected with technique, it wasn't connected with accuracy. God knows he was infamously inaccurate, but he had clearly some kind of magnetism. And I would love to have known what that sounded like.
Interesting. Okay, next
I mean,
question.
ask me the question tomorrow, I'll give you a different answer.
I'm absolutely sure. One person you'd love to play for, dead or alive.
Oh my word. Yeah, Hensoldt.
Yeah, what do you think of my interpretations, Hensel?
He was there's a really cool set of memoirs written by an Irish pianist called Bettina Walker called My Musical Memories, and she traveled far and wide to take piano lessons with all of the most famous pianists, or many of the most famous pianists in the 19th century, including Henselt. And Henselt is the final chapter in her book, and she traveled to St. Petersburg to take lessons with him. And his first response was, Es hat kein Fleisch, it has no flesh.
Oh.
He delegated to one of his lady drill mistresses, who said, "Madam, it is time to work, and yes, even possibly hurt your fingers." The strictures of the thing, but I think nonetheless, they said people who studied with him that the lesson began when he started demonstrating,
Okay.
and he used to say things like, "Imagine you're sinking your fingers into bread dough." When you're producing sound on the piano. Yeah, I would have loved to have had a piano lesson with him. No, I wouldn't care how severe he was. Just.
That's great. That's great. Oh dear. Okay. Do you yourself have any technical struggles?
All the bloody time. All the time. And I always put myself back to, I'm a practitioner of yoga. And what I say to my students is cultivate the observant mind and hope they never hear me practicing.
Great.
In general, I think it is a struggle. And I think all of us have things that we're good at and things that we're bad at. You know, that's a thing. There are some pianists who just don't have any difficulties with double octaves, some pianists who don't have any difficulties playing thirds and sixths, for example. Some people just have a knack for stuff. There are things I have a knack for. There are things I don't find difficult.
Yes.
There are things that I absolutely crucify myself over when I'm practicing. But thinking back to my yoga practice, my job there is to observe. And my job when I practice the piano is to observe,
Absolutely.
to take myself out of myself and just watch what's going on. And then you sort of access the teacher within. I mean, everything is, it would have no meaning if it weren't a struggle.
That's very interesting to observe. Yeah, I like that. What would be your advice to an amateur pianist about how to improve?
Observe.
Yeah.
I think there's the difficulty with the piano is if you're playing a wind instrument, your own breath is animating the sound of the instrument. If you're playing the violin, you literally embrace the instrument and feel it vibrating. We're playing the piano by remote control. We have such an indirect, tactile communication with the instrument. When you think about it, between the finger touching the ivory and what's actually I call it the bird skeleton, that incredibly delicate piano action that can produce that gigantic sound. All those little tiny moving pieces, these little series events that have to happen before the sound is produced. So therefore, I think pianists often have this difficulty of actually hearing themselves.
Absolutely.
So I think really, being aware of the vibration of the string is the first fundamental.
Would you suggest then to record
Well, just
yourself?
listening to long notes. Listening to long notes, training your ear to hear all of the upper partials vibrating. You know,
Goodness.
if you play the bottom note on the piano,
Yeah.
train your ear to pick out all of the overtones. So you really, really develop a contact with how the instrument sounds and vibrates and make friends with it. You know, I think that's a real basic fundamental for all pianists.
Wow. Fascinating.
And
Fascinating. You
if you don't have that, you can't really listen to yourself. You can't
Interesting.
really understand the sound you're producing if you haven't really understood the basic sound of the instrument itself.
All right. Well, after this conversation, I'll go away and hit the bass note of the piano. Give it a try. Okay. If you weren't a pianist, what would you be?
I don't know. I don't know. An engineer.
Okay.
I like knowing how stuff fits together.
Okay.
You know, that's something that I've like with music analysis and stuff. I don't think it actually has any direct bearing on my interpretations, but I like knowing it.
Yes,
I like
I'm
knowing
sure
how
it
things
does.
work.
I'm sure
So
it
yeah,
does.
probably something like that.
Interesting. Last question. One composer you're not quite ready to tackle.
There is a really weird answer to this. There's a compo is an obscure Russian
Oh.
called Stanchinsky. I'd
Okay.
always wanted to play. Now, this is very much music of the mind. He died young, probably suicide, and he wrote some piano. Actually, I think Thomas Addis has recorded some of the piano music.
When did he die? Is he really?
He was very, very ahead of his time.
Yes.
And I tried playing, I swear it's the most difficult piece of music I've ever learned. It's a B major etude. And in terms of cross rhythms, you've got one, two, three, four, five, one, two, three, four. You've got nine semiquavers in a bar in the left hand. The right hand is written in 5/8. And you have a melody written in quavers in 5/8, accompanied by three groups of five semiquavers in the same hand. The melody comes back halfway through in canon.
Oh my
So it's got
goodness.
this sort of contrapuntal trick. And so it's not long. I mean, it's not a long piece. It's so difficult and so complicated to learn, but so fascinating.
Yeah.
And I've always said to myself, I prepared it for I've never really been good with competitions. I prepared it for a competition when I was really young, never got to the final, therefore never played it. Thank God. Always promised myself I was going to return to Stanchinsky's music later in my life, and the time just isn't there yet. You know, it's just
Well, you're young, you've still
well,
got loads of time.
I'm anyhow. No, I'm not young. I'm not young at all. I remember I was reading there was a fascinating article, I think it was in the New York Times, with this was Benjamin Grosvenor talking about his own, I have to say, really excellent recording of the Liszt Sonata. And he was talking about having studied the recordings of the old masters. And one of the old masters was Radu Lupin. I was like, I met him. It's
Oh,
the
yeah,
ancients. So
he was
there
amazing. He was
we
amazing. Wow. Well, listen, Daniel, we've come to
Longer
the
young.
end. We've come to the end, and you've given us so much interesting information here.
Well, it's always lovely to talk to you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. And I really do look forward to hearing your interesting program in Germany. What date is it?
I'm playing in Oldenburg on the 15th and Husum on the 17th.
Okay, but I know it's all sold out anyway, isn't it?
I
Sold
think so.
out. Yeah. Yeah. But I
This
really look forward.
little guy's coming.
Oh, is that your dog in the
They're
background?
doing a road trip and taking Bar.
Oh. Oh.
Yeah,
Well,
look.
listen, thank you so much for being on the Pianist Podcast. It's time to say goodbye.
Well, lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you, Daniel. And yeah, good luck with the summer and beyond and learning the Stanchinsky one day.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you so much. That was an excerpt from Schumann's Carnival, and it was played by Daniel Grimwood on an 1851 Erard piano. Pianist podcasts are free, and a really good way to support what we do is by subscribing to Pianist. Visit our website at pianistmagazine.com and listen to us on YouTube by searching Pianist Magazine. And don't forget to sign up to our newsletter, which is full of extra playing tips and useful information. Go to pianistmagazine.com to find out how to sign up.